Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Violence in America. Families of mass shooting victims join President Biden to recognize the significance of a new gun law and demand that more be done. We look at calls to release more images of the deadly attacks and why many families are opposed. Then, aging together. Inflation and high housing costs spur more baby boomers to find roommates.
I like saving money. I like having another person to talk to have a relationship with. It's nice to have some companionship when you're at home.
And the Uber files. Thousands of leaked documents show how ride-sharing company Uber skirted laws and regulations as it expanded worldwide. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A federal judge has said no to delaying Steve Bannon's trial for contempt of Congress. It is set to begin next Monday. The former Trump White House advisor had refused to cooperate with a January 6th investigation. Then he reversed course over the weekend. Bannon's lawyers would not say if today's ruling changes his decision to testify. President Biden hailed a new federal law aimed at gun violence today, but he also called for more. He said it's time to hold gun owners accountable for weapons used in shootings. The president spoke 16 days after signing the new law and 1 week after the attack on a July 4th parade outside Chicago. We'll return to this after the news summary. Police in South Africa are still hunting for five gunmen who killed 15 people in a crowded bar early Sunday. The attack in Soweto was the worst of three such incidents that killed 21 people in all. Gunmen burst into taverns and fired scores of rounds. Investigators suspect regional and ethnic rivalries or fights between crime gangs. In Ukraine, the death toll rose to 31. In a Russian missile strike Saturday on an apartment block in the Donetsk region, farther north, rockets hit Ukraine's second largest city, Kharkiv. That was today, and killing at least six people and wounding dozens. Survivors said they had no warning.
I woke up in bed and I was all covered in dust. I went to the bathroom where more rubble and dust fell on me. Finally, when I saw lights, I started screaming, "I'm alive! Please get me out!" Then the rescuers knocked down the door and took me out.
Also today, the White House warned that Russia is asking Iran for hundreds of armed drones for use in Ukraine. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said it appears that Iran is ready to provide the weapons and the training. New COVID-19 outbreaks are being reported in China, including in the gambling mecca of Macau. Casinos and streets across the territory were empty. Businesses were ordered to close, and residents were told to stay indoors. Meanwhile, yet another highly contagious mutation gained momentum in India. Scientists say that the BA.2.75 subvariant may be able to defeat vaccines and other immunity. The political crisis in Sri Lanka took a new turn today. Officials on the Indian Ocean island said that Parliament will vote on a new president next week. That's after mass protests in the capital forced the president and prime minister to offer their resignations. Peter Smith of Independent Television News is in Colombo and filed this report.
In Sri Lanka, the queue for petrol no longer lasts for hours. The wait is now measured in days. This is what it looks like when the country runs out of fuel and money. Protesters have stormed the gates of the presidential palace, and from what we saw today, they have now taken over.
We will win because people are united.
This president is not coming back here.
You'll never come. Never if come. He come here, our people will kick out him.
The writing is now on the wall for the Sri Lankan regime. The black flag of the protesters now flies here. The new occupants experience the luxury of a presidential bed, and there have been queues to take a dip in the president's pool.
The fact we, along with these people, can walk through this palace at our leisure tells us power in Sri Lanka no longer lies in the hands of the president, but it's not yet in the hands of the people, because the military still surrounds this place. Heavily armed guards are overseeing this delicate revolution.
Police have already fired tear gas on protesters. The guns haven't gone away, but people here tell me they are simply no longer scared. With no gas for stoves, people in Sri Lanka now buy wood to cook in the streets. Community kitchens feed those without fuel or food. Dizala Rodrigo has been camped outside this palace since April. Now she's inside the president's old gym.
We don't have a gas cylinder to cook. Even if we have induction electric cookers, we don't have electricity. There's a power cut going on every day. So that's the main reason why I'm here.
Sri Lanka's president is now in hiding and has briefed that he'll resign on Wednesday. The people say they'll believe it when they see it. Until then, they stay put and hold on to hope.
That report from Peter Smith of Independent Television News. Monsoon rains in Pakistan have now claimed at least 150 lives in less than a month, with new flooding in the country's largest city. Entire neighborhoods in Karachi were underwater today after 5 inches of rain in 3 hours. Many of the port city's roads were flooded. The rainfall has been almost twice as heavy as it usually is this time of year. Back in this country, the Biden administration told hospitals that they must provide abortion services when the mother's life is at risk. The Department of Health and Human Services said that existing federal law on that point overrides any state ban that provides no exceptions. The announcement is aimed at a handful of states with exceptions that are legally vague. A French drug company is seeking the first U.S. approval of an over-the-counter birth control pill. HRA Pharma applied to the FDA today. It said the timing is unrelated to new battles over abortion rights. Birth control pills can already be purchased without a prescription in much of the world. And on Wall Street, after a winning week, stocks gave ground again over inflation and recession jitters. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 164 points to close at 31,173. The Nasdaq fell 262 points, that's 2%. The S&P 500 dropped 1%. Still to come on the NewsHour, Tamara Keith and Amy Walter explore what's behind President Biden's low approval ratings. More baby boomers move in together to offset rising housing costs. New documents show how far Uber executives were willing to go to grow their business worldwide, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
President Biden hailed the new bipartisan gun safety law at a White House ceremony earlier today. It's the first significant legislation on this passed in decades. It would expand background checks to younger adults who are trying to buy guns. It would expand the use of red flag laws and also close a loophole in efforts to deny firearms to dating partners of convicted domestic abuse.
That's what we owe those families in Buffalo, where a grocery store became a killing field. It's what we owe those families in Uvalde, where an elementary school became a killing field. That's what we owe those families in Highland Park, where on July 4th, a parade became a killing field. And that's what we owe all of those families represented here today and all over this country. We'll not save every life from the epidemic of gun violence, but if this law had been in place years ago, even this last year, lives would have been saved. It matters. It matters. But it's not enough, and we all know that.
President Biden said he wanted to see much more done, including a ban on assault weapons. But as he was delivering his remarks, he was heckled by a father whose son died in the Parkland, Florida shooting in 2018. Manuel Oliver shouted at the president that he wanted to see more done. In response, Mr. Biden initially told him to sit down to hear what he had to say, then said he should speak. But Oliver was soon escorted out. That frustration about the limits of this law has been echoed around the country by those who are asking what more can be done. Alongside this legislative push is another conversation about what role journalism might play in helping address this crisis. William Brangham looks at that.
Judy, that discussion centers around whether the media should show graphic images of precisely what gun violence does to its victims. For example, some of the children who were shot in Uvalde, Texas, were so disfigured that they could only be identified by their sneakers or by DNA samples. Should images of that kind of violence ever be shown? What purpose would it serve? And who gets to decide? There are, of course, strong opinions on all sides of this debate. We wrestle with it here at the NewsHour. And so we wanted to hear tonight from two voices. First, someone who believes that, on balance, the public does need to see these tragedies explicitly. Ed Wasserman teaches journalism and was the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. I spoke with him earlier today. Ed Wasserman, very good to have you on the NewsHour. I know you didn't come to this position easily, but can you make the case why should these images be shown?
It is true that it is not an easy judgment to make. And it is unquestionably true that there are powerful ethical arguments against the position that I'm going to put forth, which is, I think, what the media ought to be, concerns what the media ought to be doing. Certainly, showing images of this kind of carnage is tremendously traumatic for the public. These are images that haunt and that stalk people after they've seen them. And it's a tremendous disrespect and indignity to the people who have lost loved ones. So there's no question but that the kinds of images that I'm talking about putting into wider circulation are going to come at a cost. My concern is that we are a powerfully visual culture, and we believe things when we see them. And the dominant images that the public takes away from these killings are somber, respectful images of candlelight vigil and quietly mourning parents. And that is doing a gross injustice to the actual carnage that's being perpetrated. And I think that until, in the same way that Black Lives Matter came to light, when the images of people being killed by police became publicly available, I think we're not going to respond to these instances of massacres with the anger and disgust that they demand until we have a chance to see just what has been done.
So you think that those memorials, the stories about the victims, the statistics and the data that have been repeated so often about homicides and mass shootings and suicides isn't enough, that it's journalistically negligent to not go this one step further?
I think it borders on concealment. And I think that the question of how much do you have to see before the experience and the reality becomes clear to you is an open question, and it varies with individuals. And I'm not counseling editors to begin a cascade of horrendous and gruesome images of dead children. That's not the point. The point is that we see nothing of the dead in the images that the media provide us with. They are off screen. They are simple setups for the mourning and for the prayer sessions and all the rest of it. We don't see what's going on. And I think that what has happened is sufficiently horrendous that it would change attitudes. It would awaken people to just what it is that goes on. And the media, by not showing us the aftermath of that, are pandering to that. And they're enabling that to be perpetuated. And I fear that it's almost a dare. It almost goads the more pathologically twisted of us to have a go themselves.
One question is access. I mean, a lot of these photographs are not readily available. These are crime scenes. Do you think that journalistic organizations should press for more access to forensic images, to police photographs, to get this out?
Well, I do. I question how unavailable these images are, certainly at the point at which people come to trial. And let me just make a different, somewhat related. The reason why they don't is a good question to kind of raise. And I think that it's important for the public to understand the extreme reluctance that editors have in presenting these images to them. The idea that they that news organizations will look for cheap and tawdry and obscene and gruesome images because they believe the public likes that and it'll sell newspapers or enhance audience size is totally false. Audiences hate this stuff. And news editors present it to audiences with only the greatest reluctance. So this represents, from the part of the media, an act, in my view, of courage. They've got to show these images not because it's tasteful, not because it's something that will advance their own interests as media organizations, but because the public needs to see these things to fully understand the horror that's being routinely perpetrated on us.
What about the argument that is made that about who gets to decide this? Because I know that there are certainly lots of families of victims who believe that this is a terrible idea, that no matter what benefit that this might yield, that those families will be forever traumatized if those images are out there, that the darker culture that exists on the internet and in this world will be constantly bombarding those people with those images of their loved ones in the worst possible moment of their lives, and that they will never be able to get past that.
I don't have a good answer for that. That is true. This is not being done to benefit the families who've lost children or lost family members to these kinds of things. This is not in their interest. It may be in the interest of the other families who perhaps are spared this because of the greater public anger and disgust at what these images portray. But this is not in these families' interest. It's a tremendous indignity, and it deepens their loss. And so I have nothing but compassion for them. But I'm saying that it is a classic dilemma. It's a wrong versus a wrong. And my belief is that the wrong that's done by concealment outweighs the wrong that's done by exposure.
All right, Ed Wasserman, former dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, William.
Okay, so that is one argument in favor of this. For a different take, I'm joined now by a parent who lost her own daughter in the mass shooting at a movie theater 10 years ago in Aurora, Colorado. Sandy Phillips is a proponent of stronger gun safety measures, and she was at the White House ceremony with President Biden today. Sandy Phillips, great to have you back on the NewsHour. You heard what Ed Wasserman was saying here, that the way in which we show our culture these tragedies is too sanitized and that we need to do differently. What do you think about that idea?
I think it's a horrible idea as a parent of a child that was murdered. My daughter was shot 6 times with 223s from an AR-15. And when I speak very clearly about what happened to her in the theater and the wounds that she sustained. When we went to trial, the medical examiner, when he was discussing her wounds, wept. He wept on the stand. He just started crying. And we were at the courtroom, but we weren't in the courtroom when that happened. And after he finished his descriptions of what had happened to my daughter, when the press walked out and the rest of the people that were in the courtroom that day walked out, they were all either crying or ashened or shocked. So I understand what he's saying. You almost have to see it to believe it. The problem is our society doesn't believe what they see anymore anyway. And what you're
meaning
asking,
that the images would be challenged as fake and
exactly. I mean, Sandy Hook is challenged as not ever happening. Highland Park already has, and this happens after every mass shooting. There's immediate conspiracy theories that this never happened. So would that make it stop? No. Then they just challenged the pictures. A few years ago, there were some doctors that went on Capitol Hill to lobby, and they took the pictures of bodies who had been shot by AR-15s and other weapons. And it didn't make a difference at all. So why should we as parents be asked to carry that burden for society? It's too much to ask of us. It truly is one of those things that how much more trauma do we have to endure? And just by him talking about how that might make a difference, is traumatizing for a lot of us survivors out here.
Well, we certainly, that's the last thing we want to do to you all, and we appreciate you being open to talking about this with us. But I want to circle back to this point that you're making about the experience that people had in the courtroom when they did see the horror that was visited on your daughter, who is here with us on your shirt today. You don't think that there's any possible benefit for the rest of the country, the good-hearted people of this country, to see what high-powered weapons actually do to children?
You know, they can go online and see what AR-15s do to a watermelon and how it explodes a watermelon. They can go online and see that damage that it does to a mannequin. They can see damage that it does to a deer. They don't need and they aren't privileged to see what that did to my daughter. And I don't want that image ever to be out there for anyone else to see. I certainly don't want it there for my son to have to see. And then I think of my cousins, my nephews, right? It goes on and on.
Grandchildren, right.
Exactly, the ripple effect. And they will live forever on the internet. So is that something that we as a society really want to do to the families that have already lost so much, had so much taken from them? I hope not.
If the images were anonymized, how would you feel about that?
Well, that's perfectly okay. And I'm perfectly okay with a family member saying, I'm okay with doing this, because they understand what that's going to mean to them. And if they're okay, it's a very personal choice. And if they're okay with that, I say more power to them, much like Emmett Till's and being able to change society. The mother in Sandy Hook, one of the mothers there, had the governor come in to see the damage that was done to her son. I think all of those things are important, but I don't think we should make it a blind, you know, every time there's a mass shooting, let's show the carnage. Because those pictures last forever, and the people that are affected by it have to witness that over and over again. We have a dear friend whose daughter was killed on camera, and he has been trying to get that taken down from YouTube for over five, six years now, because he's out there, and he never knows when he's going to open up an email, and it might be there. He never knows when his wife might open an email and it's there. So this is really an unfair burden to ask of any of us. It's an okay burden to ask of our elected leaders, and we should be asking them to witness what actually happens. They should be made to go down and go into those classrooms where children have been literally decapitated by bullets and can only be identified through DNA. They should be the ones that go down there and witness it. We shouldn't have to.
Sandy Phillips, always great to see you. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, William.
The Congressional Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol is scheduled to hold a hearing tomorrow focused on the role that extremist groups played that day. This as the Senate gears up for a busy, high-stakes July. Our political correspondent Lisa Desjardins has more on the latest developments. So, hello, Lisa. I know you've been following us. So, tell us, where are we in terms of these hearings? What are they going to be focusing on? Where are we overall in terms of the subject matter? And when does it look as if they're going to try to finish?
Right. These are the good questions we're all asking. Tomorrow's hearing is the seventh hearing for the January 6th Select Committee. And we did at one point expect this week to be the final week for a while. However, that's changing even as we speak. I'm going to come back to that. First, let's talk about tomorrow, what we're going to be hearing from the committee. The focus so far has been on Trump and what he's done, his direct actions. Tomorrow, Judy, we're going to hear more about white nationalist groups and their ties to those around former President Trump when he was in the White House. In particular, a meeting in December that preceded former President Trump tweeting out that invitation to come to the rally on January 6th. We're going to hear probably about advisors like Roger Stone and their ties that the committee will try to make to white nationalist group like the Proud Boys, who we know were at the Capitol and have now been arrested for their role in the riot there. One other thing, we're waiting to see what happens with Pat Cipollone, the former attorney, the counsel for President Trump when he was in the White House. He testified behind closed doors for 8 hours on Friday. Now, my reporting is that he does not want to participate in a public hearing. We do not expect to see him this week. We may hear some of his hearing tomorrow, but I think the committee is going to wait to have more of that hearing further ahead. And that's why we're going to have more hearings next week. There will only be one hearing this week. Tomorrow, the committee says it's getting more information. And some of my sources say that is why the committee is going to have another hearing next week. We don't know exactly when these hearings will end.
And so, Lisa, what is known about the president, former President Trump's close ally, Steve Bannon? Do we think he's going to be testifying?
Right. As you reported at the very beginning of the show, we now know that Steve Bannon is set for trial on contempt of Congress in 1 week. Those in Congress and on the committee say it's no coincidence that all of a sudden now he wants to cooperate. They think he's a last-ditch effort to try and save himself from trial. And also they believe that this is a sign that the committee is doing its work and President Trump and his allies want to respond more publicly. We don't know yet, because the committee has not frankly decided, is my reporting, exactly how they're going to handle this. But here's what one of the committee members, Zoe Lofgren, said on television Sunday about the idea of questioning Steve Bannon.
We got the letter around midnight from his lawyer saying that he would testify, and we have wanted him to testify. So the committee, of course, has not yet had a chance to discuss it, but I expect that we will be hearing from him, and there are many questions that we have for him.
One last thing to keep in mind, Judy, whether he talks to the committee or not, it doesn't affect the criminal charges necessarily. He already rejected the original subpoena. That's something the committee might bring up.
And so, Lisa, as all this is going on, meantime, in the Senate, they are looking at, a couple of do or die weeks for their agenda. What does it look like there?
Okay, roll up your sleeves. We've got a lot to talk about, but I'm going to try and make it sort of palatable. First, two very important senators, Joe Manchin and Chuck Schumer, two top Democrats, are now negotiating fully for sort of a final or perhaps a last kind of narrowed version of the president's agenda. It used to be called Build Back Better. Well, as you know, Joe Manchin blocked that. Now they're talking about what could be left, and there is a potential outline starting to emerge for what's called a reconciliation or sort of Biden agenda deal. But, Judy, there are some problems here in terms of tactics and some important negotiating stances I want to talk about. There are a number of high-stakes bills. So let's look at what's happening in the next 3 weeks, what we should be watching. Three high-stakes bills are moving that have some bipartisan support, one on China competitiveness and the need for the U.S. to make microchips in particular and work on manufacturing of processors, those kinds of ingredients. Also, an insulin drug pricing bill that would reduce the price of insulin. And also a bill, there is an agreement, a bipartisan agreement on reforming the Electoral Count Act. The problems with that act, of course, were a factor in January 6th. All of those bills have some kind of bipartisan momentum right now. The problem is, at the same time now, we have the Democrats talking about perhaps this combination reconciliation bill, the Manchin-Schumer idea, which would include drug prices and climate change, that narrow kind of Biden agenda bill. That is a partisan bill. So, where are we? Senator McConnell, a Republican leader, has said if that partisan reconciliation bill moves forward, then those other bills, the bipartisan efforts, especially the China bill, he would block them. So we're in this kind of standoff where all of these bills are connected to one another, Judy, and it's going to be very important because each one of them has very critical implications for our country.
No question, and we will see how these weeks, coming weeks, play out. Lisa Desjardins watching it all very closely. Thank you, Lisa. And we will have live coverage of the January 6th committee hearing that Lisa was just telling us about. That begins tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern here on PBS and streaming online at pbs.org/newshour. Just months before the midterm elections, a handful of domestic issues are driving the political agenda. Rising inflation, a series of high-profile shootings, and the overturning of Roe versus Wade. It's all dragging down President Biden's approval ratings. In a New York Times Siena College poll, 60% of Americans say they disapprove of the job the president's doing. That includes a quarter of his own party. And the concerning number for Democrats running this year, more than two-thirds of independent voters say they disapprove of the president's job performance. To discuss the political stakes at the moment, I'm joined now by Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Welcome to you both on this Monday, Politics Monday. So, Amy, what everybody wants to know is, why is this happening? Why is President Biden doing so poorly in the polls a year and a half into his term?
A year and a half in. And I also want to put this into context, Judy. I mean, this is one poll, but if you look at an average of all the polls, the president's overall approval rating now at 38%. It is the lowest approval rating we've seen at a president at this point in his term going all the way back to Eisenhower. So this is quite, for Democrats, not a very good milestone. For the president, not a great milestone. Why does he get there? You listed all of those reasons in your opener. The economy, the mass shootings, COVID now, we have a sudden resurgence of a new variant. It feels as if, one, things are sort of out of control, and two, the president not really feeling, people not feeling like he has his hand firmly on the steering wheel. He was elected in part by saying, I'm going to help us get away from, or at least navigate us through the chaos. Now it feels like the chaos is still controlling us as a country, and the president feels to many people like he's a step behind. For Democrats, the frustration is about a president they don't feel is taking it to Republicans hard enough. I talk to a lot of Democrats who say, we want to see the president fight harder against Republicans like Mitch McConnell, not let him drive the agenda. And for independent voters, I do think it comes to this sense of they just feel overwhelmed by the economy and how much these day-to-day increases in everything from groceries to rent to gas has impacted their lives.
Tam, you've been watching this White House very closely. What else do you see going on here?
The American public is in a very sour mood, mm-hmm. and we've talked about this before, yeah. but inflation is probably the one thing that maybe across the political spectrum people can agree is something that is a real concern. Every time you go fill up your tank, the price of gas is very high, though it has been coming down in recent days. But in addition to that, there are reasons that people on the left feel like the country is going in the wrong direction, and they're incredibly frustrated, whether it be the mass shootings and feeling like, you know, the president held a celebration today for gun safety legislation that a lot of people felt wasn't worthy of celebration, that it was an incremental step at a time when people want radical change. On abortion rights, the same thing, that there's this level of frustration that the president just can't do more. And so the people on the left who, you know, Democrats, 25% of Democrats, don't approve of the president's performance, that really takes a hit into your numbers when your own party isn't fully behind you. And the reason that they have that reticence is, as Amy says, they want more. And also, I think that the White House would argue that the challenge he faces right now is there is no alternative. It's not Joe Biden versus someone else. It's just, how do you feel about the president? How do you feel about the country? Well, not great.
And so when Democrats are asked, I mean, to dig a little further, I mean, when Democrats are asked in this poll whether Joe Biden should run again, President Biden should run again, Amy, only 26%. This is Democrats say, right. Yes, he should.
Right.
69% say somebody else. And when they are asked why, Democrats answer, and I'm reading here, 33% cite his age, 32% cite his job performance, 12% say they just would prefer somebody else, and 10% say he's not progressive enough.
Right. Now, if you are in the Biden White House, you would say, look, it's very early. People are understandably frustrated about where things stand today. We have a long way to go before we get to 2024, and that is fair. But the fact that we haven't even had a midterm election yet, we don't even have the results of the midterm election yet, and a quarter of Democrats saying they would support the president is a pretty bleak number. We've been seeing this number, though, for quite some time. Maybe not this high, yeah. But since the beginning of the year, about 50% of Democrats in polls have been saying they'd like somebody else new. When you break it down for what they want to see, that's where we get into the next question, right? Well, if it's not Biden, then who?
Right.
And that's where even people who follow politics for a living or are in politics for a living say, I don't know. Who would that be, and how would that happen?
Yeah, and we'll show everybody what the matchup is when you match him head to head against former President Trump. But Tam, these are tough numbers from his own party.
Yeah. So when I saw these numbers, I went and looked up this quote from March of 2020 that sticks with me, and I think potentially might explain some of this. He said in March of 2020, this is President Biden, "Look, I see myself as a bridge, not as anything else. There's an entire generation of leaders you saw stand behind me. They are the future of this country." He, in a way, pitched himself as a transitional leader, and now he's saying, "I'm running for re-election in 2024." Well, all of these voters in this poll are saying, "Wait, I thought you said you were a transitional leader, and we're moving on to the next thing." Yeah. And I think that because he presented himself in that way, that's why these numbers were this way so early.
Yeah, and so, I think we just actually showed these numbers to the viewers, Amy, but when these voters are asked about a matchup, this is all voters, a matchup between Biden and Trump, it's 44 to 41. Biden has a little bit of an edge. It's within the margin of error. Right. But among independents, which, of course, everybody watches very closely, and you talk about the independents a lot, former President Trump, slight edge, 39 to 37, 2 points. It's within the margin of error. But it's a warning sign.
Right. Well, there are two ways to look at this. One is to say, if you are in the Biden White House, you say, see, what we told you is actually true, that we are the only candidate that could beat Donald Trump. But you also say, yes, but 3 points, if we assume that's where things sit, that's basically where we were in 2020. And even though he won the popular vote by that margin, he only won the Electoral College by 40,000 votes. So we also don't have yet a matchup between any other Democrat. What it feels like is those numbers are sort of locked in amber. People who voted for Biden are still going to vote for Biden. People who voted for Trump still going to vote for Trump. With the section of people out there who are saying, ugh, I don't even want to have to make that choice right now. My guess is we're not going to see either one of those candidates on the ballot in 2024. Mm-hmm. That what voters have been telling us from very beginning of this year is they would like to see some new faces on the ballot.
In any event, it's a warning sign for the White House right now.
Yeah, well, and not one that they really want to be asked about. Yeah. Also, though, it is a long
way. By the way, they're saying
he
is running again.
Yes. Oh,
absolutely.
They are saying it repeatedly. They are saying it and pushing back and making sure that friends of Biden talk to the reporters who are working on these stories. They want to make it clear that he is running. If he were to say right now that he isn't running, then all of the oxygen would go out of the room. Any effort to get his agenda through would hit ice. And you'd end up with all of the attention focused on the intrigue and drama of
lame
who would
duck,
replace
which
him.
They don't want.
Yeah, absolutely.
They do not want that.
Absolutely.
No. All right. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, thank you both.
Thank you.
Amid high inflation and rising housing costs, it's not just young people looking for roommates. Some Americans in their 60s and 70s are turning to home sharing. Our economics correspondent Paul Solman has the story about a growing number of baby boomers who are considering becoming boommates.
I'm going to get some sunflower seeds. There.
For years, Becky Miller, age 72, had only one companion.
There you go.
Maxie, a green-cheeked conure.
That's Mommy's Maxie Bird.
But Maxie doesn't pay rent, and Miller, a retired receptionist, was having trouble making ends meet.
I'm single, so I wasn't able to put a lot into my IRA. So I depleted it. My mortgage and my HOA fees were over half of my income. So I decided for financial reasons to get a roommate.
64-year-old divorcee Marlene Mears moved into Miller's Longmont, Colorado home a year and a half ago.
I like saving money. I like having another person to talk to have a relationship with. It's nice to have some companionship when you're at home.
It's not happy.
Miller and Mears found each other on Silvernest, an internet platform that matches older homeowners with housemates.
There's a significant portion of the population going into their mid-60s, you know, with $20,000, $30,000 in their 401ks or nothing saved.
No, this one's starting to fade.
So seniors like Miller and Mears feel the need to home share, says Silvernest president Riley Gibson.
Since the start of 2022, with inflation rising, just people under so much more financial pressure, the first half of this year we've seen by far more activity, probably 2 to 3 times the activity we've seen in previous years.
But it's just part of a much longer term trend, explains Harvard's Jennifer Malinsky.
We often hear about the Golden Girls television show.
I know it's awful, but I have this incredible sweet tooth.
What is it?
Cheesecake.
What kind?
Chocolate.
Oh, I think this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship.
Turns out Dorothy, Rose, Blanche, and Sophia were a harbinger.
20 years ago, it was about 1% of older adults were house sharing with a non-relative. Today, it's over 1 million older adults, more than double the number in that time.
Small wonder, given the rise in housing costs.
Hi, come on in, folks.
Over a third of older adult households have a cost burden, paying over 30% of their income on housing. Half of those are paying more than 50% of their income on housing. What people do is they start cutting back on other necessities like food and out-of-pocket medical care, insurance, which really affects much more than your financial well-being. It affects your overall well-being.
Brenda Atchison's house in the Roxbury neighborhood of Boston has been in her family since 1946.
This is where I sleep. This is my bedroom. It has a lot of just artifacts and
stained glass.
But after a career in IT and education ended, Atchison struggled to maintain the place.
I kind of retired prematurely and realized I had a big old house that needed be heated, needed repairs, etc., and that I was older, so I knew I was moving into an area where I was going to have a fixed income, and begin to say, oh, how are we going to work this out?
She worked it out by renting a room to a young grad student.
For me, this was a major move in terms of my lifestyle, because I wasn't used to sharing space, and it's just lovely.
And this is Christian's room.
So surprisingly lovely, in fact, the student living upstairs now.
Hi, Christian. Hi.
Is roommate number six.
Hello. So, my beds. And then I spend most of my time sitting here.
Rwandan Dr. Christian Mazimpaka is studying public health at Boston University.
She's very organized, and she likes the place to be clean. And that was not new to me, because my mom was like that.
Does she remind you of your mom?
Yeah. So when I forget to take the trash out.
She'll remind you?
Yeah, she...
I see. She keeps an eye on him, he on her. But do you worry about her sometimes? I mean, particularly during COVID?
Yeah, I feel like if I stay in my room and I don't hear that movement for the whole day, I'll be worried.
And Atchison, who's single, now really likes having someone around.
To be able to be connecting with people who are outside of my sphere. Christian is not my peer. None of the students who have come here have been my peers, but have they all been my friends? Have they all taught me? See, I love learning. I just want to continue to learn.
Connection is key, since social isolation for the elderly is linked to higher risk of depression, dementia, premature death. At first, Becky Miller wasn't so sure she wanted someone sharing her Colorado space either.
I thought, oh my gosh, somebody's going to come in and use my kitchen.
I did.
And she did.
But that turned into the proverbial blessing in disguise.
I don't have to cook supper every night. We take turns cooking supper, and oh, this chicken recipe that she's making tonight. What's the name of that chicken recipe?
Mediterranean chicken thighs with lemon and garlic.
That is so good. We're having a friend over, and we're just going to pig out on that.
I think I'll let him.
But of course, taking in an unknown roommate isn't for everyone.
I don't want strangers in my house.
That's my cousin Deborah Sines. Every week I Zoom with her and other relatives, all retired single women.
I don't want I don't care how nice they are. I don't want them messing with my stuff. I just love being able to eat if I want to, not eat if I don't want to, not having to put clothes on if I don't want to, and just feeling, I think the word is free.
Does this resonate for you, Rosemary?
Yes, yes. I would rather cut down on other things than have a paying roommate.
By contrast, my sister, Ronnie, a widow, started renting out her spare room.
How much of the motivation was financial?
I'd say most of it was financial. But I found it was rewarding to have another human on the property also. Sense of company, I think.
For me, it was mostly financial.
Cousin Padme, 73, had hoped for more connection from her housemates, but...
I had a few people who were not social. I just had to let go of my ideas about more companionship.
Plant to your left palm.
As more boomers retire, and if the cost of living keeps climbing, home sharing may become a commonplace, says Silver Nest's Riley Gibson.
We're going to have to get creative and try some new things, find some new ways of living, finding new ways to think about the single family home, because we have to.
Brenda Atchison is glad she did.
Being housing insecure, that's not comfortable. It's not, I can tell you, it's not a comfortable feeling. I lived on that edge for quite some time, so I don't ever want to go back to that.
But she says,
it's the social piece that means more to me now than the financial piece ever could.
Becky Miller, she agrees.
I get a feeling of peace. I have always been by myself, and I've discovered that I have room in my heart for another person.
Relationships born of necessity that have grown into something a lot less transactional. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
The ride-hailing company Uber is under scrutiny after a whistleblower leaked more than 100,000 documents detailing the company's aggressive tactics it has expanded abroad, including efforts to curtail laws and regulations. Stephanie Tsai has our report.
Judy, the Uber files consist of emails, text messages, memos, and other records that purportedly show, among many questionable tactics, that Uber used technology to cut access to its internal systems from regulators and law enforcement using a kill switch, and that the company used violence against its drivers as a PR tool to win public sympathy. Doug McMillan is a corporate accountability reporter for The Washington Post who has been covering this story and joins us now from Washington, D.C. Doug, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. So I want to dive right into these findings, one of the main ones being about how then-CEO Travis Kalanick allegedly exploited the anger being directed against Uber drivers. This was in Paris and Europe around 2016. Can you explain what was discovered about what Kalanick did and why it was so egregious?
Yeah, so everywhere Uber expanded, there was a tension with the local taxi industry where, you know, these taxi drivers who have been some had invested their whole lives and their whole careers in having these taxi jobs saw Uber as a threat to their livelihoods. And in some places, they reacted with physical violence against Uber drivers. And we saw this across Europe, and in particular in France. We saw a moment in time where there were a lot of attacks against Uber drivers and where the executives of the company were starting to look at these attacks and look at the possibility of not focusing on how do we protect our drivers and how do we keep them safe, but potentially using these incidents of violence for Uber's own political gain. And so the text conversation we saw, which kind of is the most striking document in all 124,000 documents in this trove of the Uber files, was that Travis Kalanick was looking at this possible demonstration where his drivers would be put at physical risk and said, I think it's worth it. Violence guarantees success. So this kind of like reframing violence against his own drivers, the people who kind of has built his service on, I think is what, you know, is kind of shocking to a lot of people who, you know, expected kind of more interest in promoting and protecting the safety of these people.
And for his part, Kalanick's spokesperson issued a statement, and this is what it said. Mr. Kalanick never suggested that Uber should take advantage of violence at the expense of driver safety. Any accusation that Mr. Kalanick directed, engaged in, or was involved in any of these activities is completely false. Are any of the actions in the Uber files, including this supposed exploitation of the violence that was already occurring between taxi drivers and Uber drivers, criminal? Was it illegal?
There's no indication that Uber has broken any laws here. I'm sure people will be looking at that and studying that, you know, as there's, you know, as we look at these Uber files and these documents. But kind of the main takeaway for me was that the story of Uber and Uber's growth as an aggressive kind of hardball tactics company that took kind of very aggressive measures to get a foothold in markets around the world. It's kind of surprising the disregard sometimes that the managers of this company show for sometimes their own drivers and their own employees. The disregard sometimes they show for law enforcement. There's one particular episode which stuck out, in which Uber is using a software system they developed called the Kill Switch. And this is in the lead up to a potential law enforcement raid on Uber's Amsterdam headquarters. Travis Kalanick, the former CEO at the time, says to his managers in Amsterdam, hit the kill switch. And by that he meant cut off access to all data on our computers, you know, potentially to prevent law enforcement investigation of that data. And so, you know, here we have a company that's actually developing software for the express purpose of trying to, you know, evade law enforcement efforts to hold them accountable.
Yeah, and Uber has said that that was to protect intellectual property for their part. Why did the whistleblower, who ends up being a former company lobbyist named Mark McGann, want to reveal these details?
Mark McGann said that he was worried that Uber had sold a lie, that the people that Uber had recruited to its service, a lot of low-income people that it recruited to be drivers of the service, were told this vision of, if you drive for Uber, you are going to build a better life for yourself, and we are going to empower you to be an entrepreneur. And Mark McGann is saying, you know, this message didn't sit well with him in the years since he's left the company, because what ended up happening to a lot of these people is that they didn't improve their lives. A lot of these people ended up in debt to rental car companies that they owed money to. And some of the people in our reporting the Washington Post showed ended up with you know, threats to their physical safety. Sometimes, you know, when Uber implemented cash payments in its app in South Africa, for example, that generated a lot of criminal activity of Uber drivers being targeted for crime on their app. So a lot of times these drivers were sold this vision of Uber's going to help you improve your life. And they actually did the opposite. It did not help them improve their life. And, you know, I think the source of these leaks has been kind of worried about that. And that was part of his motivation for coming forward with these documents.
And we should say that Uber today says this is all in the past. They have had new leadership for the last 5 years. We'll have to leave it there. Doug McMillon of The Washington Post, thanks for joining the NewsHour.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you, Stephanie. And a note online. See the first image produced by the Webb Space Telescope. The image unveiled late today is filled with stars and galaxies, and it is the farthest humanity has ever seen into the universe. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Don't forget to join us tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern for live coverage of the January 6th committee hearing. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe. And we'll see you soon.